Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was younger, so much.
Welcome to Real Recovery, now in its sixth year. In the contract in George's rider, I have to always let listeners know that he, when he was 9 years old, won the punt, pass, and kick competition in Edina. You know, then he was... went on to be offered a partial ping-pong scholarship at Mount Adufus Junior College. So he's quite an athlete, but he's here in studio. Hello, George.
Thanks, Bill. Most DUIs in a six-month period in Hennepin County. I still hold the record. Good to see you.
Congratulations.
Great.
Thank you. So do you. It's nice to be in studio. And,
well, let's keep lying to each other when we go through the show. I was going to ask you before the show, can you print up the step in case I blow it?
Yeah, I probably could.
Okay.
Do you know what step you want to be talking about?
Well,
tonight?
I wanted to do step 11, and I think it's sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. But I know as I've aged, I sometimes mess that up.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of a good verse that would apply to step 11. Would it be First John 4:19? We love because He first loved us, and we want to seek God's will for our life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's right on the money. The reason we wanted to talk about this is a lot of people that I run into, and I find this in my own conversations in my head, which are numerous and constant.
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to do? And I want God to help me get my agenda. And what this step is saying is we spend time with God through meditation and in His Word. And meditation, of course, isn't thinking about ourselves. I know a lot of people in recovery groups that go to meditation groups and they focus on themselves. That's not good. Focusing on myself is what got me in here into recovery in the first place, my egocentrism and self-centeredness. Not looking for any feedback here from
across the room. I'm going to be quiet.
But we focus on Scripture like you just talked about, and we want God's knowledge of Him to be more Christ-like. But what would He have us do, Bill? That's what we're here for. And if you really want to get an impact out of your recovery and on your life, share what God did in your life with other people. Because the reason we do this show, everybody, is we love seeing what God did in our life, in other people. We have a God who we can't see, but we get to see the resurrection power in everyone else's life that He works with. And Bill, I know that's one of your favorite verses from Philippians. What is it, 3:10?
3:10, that I may know Him in the power of His resurrection and also to share in His suffering. And I don't think we talk about that very often because nobody wants to share in anybody's suffering, but God calls us to do that.
I suffer immensely an hour a week. I don't want to go into any details here.
Here we go.
But that's part of it. But you're right. Who wants to sign up for suffering?
Yeah, but this is what God calls us to do. And it's the antithesis of what the world says you should want to do. You should avoid suffering at all costs. And I think we learn to embrace it because this is the short, brittle life that God will take us from one day into His timeless kingdom to be with Him for all of eternity. So I think we spend way too much time trying to look for the shallow, short pleasures in this life. We need to keep our eyes fixed on God and what's ahead.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a tall order for me to do because, if I don't get that instant gratification, but that is what we're playing for. And actually, I think what this gets into is why are we here? We're here to do God's will. And for me, there's always that little bit of prosperity gospel that if I do all the right things, everything's going to work out. That's not biblical.
Okay.
Sorry, I interrupt your computer typing over there.
What do you have any more thoughts on that, George?
Well, that was kind of a segue to you.
That was
you know what I mean? I've got God, I've got eternal life, I've got forgiveness of my sins, not to use that as leeway for bad behavior, but nothing bad's ever going to happen to me. They killed Jesus, right? I mean, I know God allowed that, and that's part of the plan. I don't think we can join Him in His joy if we're not willing to join Him in His suffering, and for me, that is something I really don't want to do.
Mm-hmm. I want to praise Him always, though. I want to give God glory. And I think sometimes when you're in situations that are difficult and you're suffering and you feel alone and you feel like you have no hope, God is with you. God is going to be there for you. God will never leave you or forsake you, but you have to invite him into your life.
Absolutely. And the one thing that I see in people in addiction and struggling, no matter what the addiction is they've lost hope. The problem is we have hope in the wrong things. And the only hope that you can ever have that's going to work is hope in Jesus. And as you get down the scale and you suffer more and more and your consequences build up, the Holy Spirit can break through. And maybe he's talking to you tonight. The reason you're listening to the show, maybe it's the first time. Maybe you've done it before and you thought, maybe I should do that. The time is now. And I see windows of opportunity, Bill, and I can't explain this. But a lot of the guys I work with think, well, I'll use one more time and then I'll get back in the program if it doesn't work. And they die.
Mm-hmm.
It is appointed once to man to die and then the judgment. And I want everybody to be saved. And part of that, I hope, is your sobriety. But, of course, sobriety, you know, doesn't give you salvation any more than salvation gives you sobriety. And we could talk for hours on that, but I need to pick up my cross and deny myself daily, Bill.
And George, God's plan always involves peace. I mean, I see so many places in Scripture where God talks about peace. So I want to remind listeners, if you are in a place of maybe desperation tonight and you have no peace and you are experiencing panic because of your situation, and you're facing Monday morning, tomorrow, and you're nervous, God's plan is peace, that shalom peace that was in the garden. I mean, let's look at what God's design is for our life. Jesus says in John 14:27, peace is what I leave with you. It is my own peace I give you. I don't give it as the world does. Do not be worried and upset. Do not be afraid. So when I think of the peace that Jesus himself gives, if that doesn't intrigue you to want to know more, I don't know. Help me, George.
Well, I think that was very surprisingly interesting from that side of the studio.
Thank you.
Tonight.
Thank you.
Sunday night, because you confused me a little bit there. But what I think, you know, the peace that the world gives, Bill, you can look at me, eyes here, that it's circumstantial, right? I've got peace because my kids are doing well in school, my job's going well.
You don't have a job.
I don't have any kids either. I have stepkids. And I, you know, fortunately, other people raised them. And now I get them, and I'm trying not to mess them up. Total honesty here. But the peace with Jesus is not based on circumstances. It's just always there.
I agree. George, let's talk about our guest tonight.
I don't think we should talk anymore.
I don't think we should either. I want to just set the table for our guest. Lee Wolf
Good
Bloom.
Pun.
What do you mean?
Set the table.
Well,
isn't that the title of the book?
Table in the Darkness.
Yeah. You knew that.
I did know that. That's the name of her book, Table in the Darkness, A Healing Journey Through an Eating Disorder. So Lee Wolf Bloom is a health educator at the Melrose Center for Eating Disorders in St. Louis Park. She runs recovery workshops as well as a monthly intensive family program at the Institute. So that's our in-studio guest, which I can't wait to bring on.
Well, she also does mental health counseling, and maybe we could bring her on a little early. Here's what I think is really important about this, Bill. To me, this is by far the hardest addiction or problem area to treat and work with. And the reason for that is you can't abstain completely from food. It would be like me having a couple drinks every day.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good program. We tried that many times.
Mm-hmm.
And food everywhere. And so this is the hard one, and people that have this, it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And I was reading her book last night, and there was a captivating first chapter about going off to college and talking about the freshman 15. And we're at an interesting point in the school year where a lot of kids are already getting back to school and probably will be experiencing that freshman 15. What did you do, George, your freshman year? Do you remember?
My eating was okay. It was my drinking that was the problem. But yeah, you get away from home and all of a sudden the barriers are off. You've got some freedom to do things and it's a very anxious time in your life. You're stepping out on your own and a lot of problems in people's lives occur their freshman year of college.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to bring Lee on the program in just a minute. And if this is your first time listening to Real Recovery, we're awfully glad that you have joined in, and we would love to hear from you. You can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com, if you have any questions or prayer requests. We'd love to hear from you. Also, you can go to the website, which is myfaithradio.com, and go to Real Recovery to the website, and you can download any of the previous discussions we've had with outstanding guests. We have the best guests on this show because it's really honest, raw conversation about someone's history and past through an addiction of some kind. And we cover as many bases as we can in the addiction field. And tonight, I think, is going to be extra interesting because not only is our guest outstanding, but the content is applicable to everyone, George, because I think we all have struggled from time to time with just knowing where the off switch is with food.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, Lee Wolf Bloom in studio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. Awfully glad you joined us tonight, Bill Arnold, on this side of the studio and just across the way, a man whose engine oil works harder than he does, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Hey, Billy.
We've got a great in-studio guest, Lee Wolf Bloom. She's written a book called Table in the Darkness, A Healing Journey Through an Eating Disorder. And I had the chance to have her on the afternoon show, which it was just such a big hit. I thought, let's get her on Real Recovery.
Good get.
Yeah, thank you. And she's here in studio.
Hi.
So, hi.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're very glad to have you. Your book is fascinating. It felt like part of a journal. I felt like I was like I'd gotten a hold of your journal.
Yeah. Or my diary.
Or your diary, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was so personal and revealing and intimate almost in terms of your relationship just in the first couple of chapters with your dad. And that was so tender and sweet. And then going off to college and how all things started.
Yes.
So I'm dying to hear your story and take us back to an age where you feel most comfortable to get started.
Well, I know now that a lot of it occurred from an early age of growing up in a household where I was told I was the accident. So early on, I had this message being sent to me by my family, one being my dad would often say, tables aren't made for five. Well, I was the third child, which means I made it five. So I was the accident and I didn't fit at the table and roller coasters weren't made for five. So early on, there was this message that I didn't belong. So I spent most of my childhood just trying to prove that I did. And now, granted, all of this is completely unconscious, but as I grew older and my parents divorced when I was 12 and then went through some very difficult life transitions, there's a piece that happens. And if we could help younger kids to prevent eating disorders, I know now what I missed was there was no room for my own emotions. So there was no room for tears. There was no room for being sad that my parents were divorced. There was no place for having emotions. And when you don't have a place for emotions and you don't have a place to have healthy emotions, you go to a coping skill. So move forward and I go off to college and I was a smaller framed person, went through puberty very late. And so when I got off to college, I was gaining the weight that most people usually probably gained in high school, which was completely normal. But when I got to college, the transition of going to college and the emotions and the stuff I hadn't dealt with kind of hit me head on. Combine that, this is the early 90s, and I was, what I didn't know was I was struggling with depression. In the early 90s, there wasn't much information about depression. All there was those commercials on TV that had the little dot. Remember the little yellow dot that said, "Are you sad?" Remember it would bounce across the commercial? You don't remember.
I don't remember that. Do you, George? Remember that? The bouncing
dot? The little
dot?
Commercial that said,
no,
"Are you sad?"
Those were the ones with the cartoons from
yes.
Little with the song?
Yeah. Yes. Are you sad? That's all there was. So I just knew I was sad. And so growing up in a household where there was no room for sad, then I didn't know what to do. So I went home for fall break, and somebody, a family member, looked at me and said, "Oh, look who has gained the freshman 15. And you see, because I had grown up being this trying to strive to be perfect, right? Because I didn't fit in my family. I felt like I didn't fit in the world. It was kind of an unconscious, like, racing to try and be better and to be perfect. I became a Christian in high school through Young Life, and my faith only added to that. As a Christian, I could be more perfect, right? So Christianity for me wasn't even about a relationship. It was about how I could be a better person in this world, how I could be more perfect. So after the comment about the freshman 15, I decided, well, I'll just go on a diet. Well, so most eating disorders, the research shows, start with a diet, just like an alcoholic starts with a drink, a drug addict starts with a drug. So not everyone who goes on a diet develops an eating disorder. But I started dieting at a time in my life when I was miserable and I couldn't stop. And for me, it wasn't about being a certain weight. For me, it was, how could I numb out? How could I not feel? And that became a high. It became a drug for me. I couldn't get enough, more and more and more and more, until I ended up basically in a psychiatric hospital, because they didn't know what to do with me back then. Back then, they didn't have the kind of treatment centers that they have now, and ended up being diagnosed with a severe eating disorder and clinical depression.
Wow.
So there you go.
Good intro.
Yeah.
So now what do we do?
Now what do we do?
You're asking me?
No, I'm looking at you. I'm asking her. So when you find that out, what was that like for you? How did that feel?
It only reinforced that message that I had gotten my whole life. Something was wrong with me. And then now there was really something wrong with me, because I couldn't feed my body. And Christians, well-meaning Christians, would say to me, but your body is a temple of God. And so then I would feel deep shame, like, my body is a temple of God, and I'm to the point I don't know how to take care of it. So I must be a really bad person. So it only spun me into a worse shame cycle until I attempted to take my own life. So in 1990, I can't remember the year, it says it in the book, but it was about 1994, I think it was. I was done. I was like, everyone kept saying to me, if you would just pray, you'd be healed. I had gone through treatment. My parents had refinanced their house, paid for 6 months of treatment, which is not cheap. And I couldn't get better. I didn't know why I couldn't get better. I couldn't get out of my depression. I couldn't eat. I couldn't take care of myself. And everyone kept saying, if you would just pray, you'd be healed. Well, I wasn't healed. So then I deduced, God must not love me. There must be something wrong with me. So at that point, I decided to take my own life. And, well, you wonder how the story ends, right? Did she live?
I don't know.
Did she?
Can we bet on this?
This could be Lee Wolf Bloom's stunt double in studio.
Yeah, so what happened?
Well, and the interesting piece about this story is, you know, recently in the news, we just had a very well-known pastor take his own life. And we've also had other people in the Christian world who have taken their lives. And yet we are so afraid to talk about it.
That's true.
This book that I wrote wasn't sold in Christian bookstores. Why is that? I think we are afraid to talk about these things. That a Christian can be depressed and suicidal. And I was.
Mm-hmm.
And by the grace of God, I was determined that I was not going to live. And I even said, you know what, God, if I can do one thing right, I can at least do this right.
End your life?
End my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was very clear, like, I can at least do something right, and I can do this right. So it was not a cry for help. It was, I am done. And at the time, the boy I was dating woke up in the middle of the night, knew something was wrong, and came to the house that I was living at and banged down the door and they found me. And had it been an hour later, I probably would have died. So here I am in the intensive care unit of a hospital, and I'm going, I don't want to be alive. Yet I got a second chance. So what do you do with that? So really, when you talk about a crisis of faith or really figuring out what my relationship with Christ was, it happened right there in the intensive care unit of a hospital. And if you're okay, me continuing on. Okay. So I got this message. I was on my knees praying, and I got this memory of the guy at the pool in the Bible, right? The paraplegic at the pool. And he's laying there, and he's laying there by the pool, and he's saying, please, you know, why won't all these people help me? Why won't you put me in the pool? The pool will heal me. Please, somebody put me in the pool, right? And I realize I'm sitting here at the pool. This whole time, I've been praying, Jesus, why won't you heal me? Jesus, why won't you heal me? And what I didn't realize was that he was healing me, but I wasn't willing to be a part of the relationship. I wanted the magic wand, and I had to do the work. And Jesus is not, you know, we are not puppets. He asks us to be in relationship with him and to step out and to do the work with him. So I really had to kind of come to the end of myself and say, you know what, you're right. There are people in my life who want to help me. I have good treatment providers who want to help me. The problem is I wanted the magic wand. And recovery doesn't include a magic wand. It includes me stepping out, holding Jesus' hand, and saying, let's do this together. And that is when my life started to begin again.
That's powerful.
It is. I think you have to get to that point, and I think it comes from an outside agency, mm-hmm. where we get this moment of mental clarity where I need to do this. And for me, I believe that comes from the Holy Spirit, because if an outside agency didn't give it to us, if a dead man is dead in his sin, he doesn't know he's dead and there's no hope. But I think when that happens, not only do we get convicted of our issues and our struggles, but there's a hope of a way out that we believe in. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the message, though, that we often give people is we give them pithy Christianese answers instead of, no, you play a part in this. I did not choose an eating disorder. I didn't choose it. Just like you didn't choose an addiction, but I choose recovery. And for me, I had to start and God, Jesus is not going to force himself on us. He asks us very politely, sometimes banging down the door, but come with me. So from that moment on, it wasn't like I had this all of a sudden, yeah, everything's fine, everything's great. From that moment on, I realized, you know what? I have to do the work that I need to do. I have to get up every day and make a different choice. You know, the verse, choose life so that your descendants might live. You know, I had to get up every day and say, what is my choice today? Today, am I going to choose to starve myself? Today, am I going to choose to isolate?
We're going to continue this story with Lee Wolf Bloom after the break. You are listening to Real Recovery. We're so glad you joined us tonight. And George, I'm completely gripped by the story. I know you are too.
I am.
So we'll take a short break and return in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Thanks for joining us tonight, Bill Arnold, on this side of the studio, and just across the way, my co-host, George Fraser, a man who was kicked out of ukulele camp for heckling other campers. Anyway, we've got a great show tonight. Lee Wolf Bloom is in studio. We're talking about her life and her book, and it's called Table in the Darkness, A Healing Journey Through an Eating Disorder. George, you had a great question for her.
I did.
Probably forgot.
No, you know, what we were talking about on the break is I loved what she said about I didn't choose this. But what I believe is once we realize we have a responsibility. And your take on that is?
I can't get over being kicked out of ukulele camp.
I know, but that's the kind of person George is.
I was kicked out of, my husband and I were kicked out of birthing class.
Why?
Because we were laughing too much.
I like that.
Yeah.
We thought it was funny, all the breathing techniques they made you do, and so we couldn't stop laughing, so we got kicked out. Okay, anyway, so it is a choice. So, okay, regarding choice. So I have a sister, and she doesn't struggle with an eating disorder or any sort of issues like that. She doesn't struggle with any sort of addictive type issues. We are different. And so I have to realize that this is how I'm made. I have this part of me that, call it addictive personality, call it, tendency towards, destructive behaviors, whatever it is, but I have to know that about myself. And then I make the choice with Christ to move into the person God has made me to be. So part of that moment in the ICU was God, I felt like God was really saying, Hey, Lee, are you going to live your life being the person everyone else wants you to be? Are you going to be the person I've called you to be? And now it's time for you to step into that life. And that life is scary and it'll wreck you and it's awesome. And that life means you do it with me. And so that was really the beginning of doing what I needed to do. So it's very similar to recovery from drugs or alcohol in that I needed all the people around me. You cannot recover from this alone. You cannot recover from drugs and alcohol alone. It's just those people who say they do it, great. I think that's awesome. They're very few and far between. So I had to get up every day and start to ask that question. Am I going to get up and am I going to eat the meal plan that my dietitian has given me? Am I going to take the medication that I needed? For me, I needed medication. Am I going to go to therapy and be honest? All of those things were me choosing life. And I always say it's like a game. So you have over here on the left, you have choosing death. And over here on the right, you have choosing life. And every choice that I made every day would lead me to one or the other. Right. So if I'm going to skip a meal, would that lead me to death today? No, but it would eventually. Right. Because I have an eating disorder. Am I going to have suicidal thoughts or not take my medication? Every one of those leads me closer to death. So I made it like a game and I'd get up and I'd say, today I'm going to choose life. What do I need to do to choose life? I need to eat my meal and then I need to ask for help. And then I need to go and get up and do the things I need to. And the more choices I made towards life, the more I began to walk down the road of recovery. And now it's been 23 years that I'm living life in recovery. The other piece was when I was in treatment, people would tell me, oh, once you have an eating disorder, you're always going to have an eating disorder. Now, I know in chemical dependency world and substance abuse world, you say I'm an alcoholic. I'm not an anorexic. I'm Lee Bloom, and I'm loved by God. Do I have the ability to have an eating disorder tomorrow? Absolutely. But am I an eating disorder today? No. Does that make sense?
It does. The reason for me that I'll say that I'm an addict, an alcoholic, Paul said he was the chief of sinners. And I think biblically we have the... Well, the way we're identifying ourselves, how you do that is not who I used to be, but who I am in Christ now.
Right.
And I think if that's what you believe is the truth, that's who you are. But we aren't identified with our disease. For me, when I say that, it's what God did for me, what I couldn't do for myself and frankly didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. So I like how you arrive at that. But I am a child of God. I am forgiven. I am redeemed and I'm working towards sanctification. So
absolutely.
I like it.
And I like to talk about it. I like the analogy of I wear my sunblock. So I'm a very pale person and my whole entire life I wanted to be tan. So I would go to tanning salons. I would lay out on, you know, that tinfoil, everything possible. And people on the radio can't see me, but I am like lily white. I'm Scandinavian. I don't get tan. And it wasn't until my probably late 30s, after multiple sunburns and sun poisoning and then having pre-melanoma, that I was like, I think maybe I'm never going to get tan. I can look at other girls who get tan, and I can go and try and get tan, but I will never be tan. God did not make me that way. So I have to radically accept who God made me to be. God made me that I have this tendency to have addictive behaviors. So I can watch another girl go diet, but I can't diet, right? So it's the same thing with somebody who's an alcoholic. Like, we can sit and say, well, why can they have one drink? Well, they're not made like you. They can have one drink, but you can't. So that helps me radically accept who I am and know kind of what my boundaries are. So I'm very careful to protect my recovery. I wear my sunblock. I do what I need to do to make sure that I don't fall off the wagon, to make sure that I don't go back to those old ways, because Satan would love it if I'd go back to that. So I do whatever I need to do to wear my sunblock so I don't get sunburned.
What are you doing different in your 20 than what you did at first? Have you added to it? Have you subtracted from it? What are you willing to do today versus what you were willing to do at the beginning?
Oh, I'm doing so much different. One thing that I do is I never skip meals. Another is I don't ever weigh myself. I used to be obsessed about weight. And like I mentioned before, for me, it wasn't so much about appearance on the outside. It was more about numbing out.
Mm-hmm.
I started going back into therapy about 4 or 5 years ago and started really doing the deeper work and the trauma work that I had never dealt with. So remember in the beginning I talked about having all these emotions that had been stuffed down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we cope with any sort of addictive behavior because we don't want to feel. So I am now learning in my 40s, in my late 40s, learning how to feel. I never knew how to feel before. I'm learning how to have healthy emotions. I'm not willing to watch shows or read magazines or listen to anything that talks about dieting or that gets me kind of sucked into that old behavior. Now, somebody who hasn't had an eating disorder, they might read it and be fine. But I know me and I can't do that. I'm careful about how I take care of my body. I'm also careful about who I hang out with, you know, my friend group. I don't hang out with women who sit around and talk about dieting or weight. I make a choice to not do that. I also make a choice to have my time with the Lord as much as I can in the mornings, really getting in the Word and reminding myself through Scripture of who God calls me to be. Because, like I said, it's still a choice. I can be that person that the world tells me I am. I can be the person my parents told me I was. I can be the failure that I thought I was. Or I can live in the idea and the belief that God says, you're my beloved. I adore you just as you are. And I will tell you that that is a struggle every day. But I lean in to Christ and I lean into what he says about me. Because otherwise, if I look at what the world says about me, I'll go back.
Leah, I'm looking in your book and you said that you received certain messages and interpreted them through your lens. And here they are. Dieting? ? Normal. Hating your body? ? Normal. Thinness? ? Searching for it like the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
Boy, what a torturous little mind that must have been. But that must represent a lot of people.
Our culture right now is, I don't even know what the right word is. It's so upsetting to me. You mentioned in the beginning, I work at I work on the inpatient unit of a eating disorders hospital, and it's getting worse. Why are eating disorders getting worse? Why has the suicide rate gotten higher than it's ever been? It just baffles my mind. I believe a lot of it is because we have a very confused, mixed up view of the body and a very confused and mixed up view of food. And both things in our culture, the American culture especially, we've got a problem.
Can we talk about that some more?
You bet. You got
more in the tank on that?
Yep, lots
good.
In the tank.
Good, because we need to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll have that part of the discussion with Lee Wolf Bloom in just a minute. You're listening to Real Recovery, and I'm so glad you're doing that. Bill and George here in studio. We're awfully glad that you listen to the show and support us. Thank you. We'll be back in a minute. Show. Awfully glad you're listening tonight. Bill Arnold, George Fraser. We're having a great conversation with Lee Wolf Bloom. If you've missed any of this, you will definitely want to go back and hear it from the beginning. Go to myfaithradio.com. Go to Real Recovery, and you can just click on the link and find it. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or any use of the pictures or accounts of this show can be freely done without express written consent of Major League Baseball. So, George, let's talk to Lee about what she said prior to break, which is the way the world views our bodies and our food and all the problems that it produces.
Correct. I think actually you said that. But
did I say that?
I think it was you that said that. But yes, we have a culture.
So I said something interesting.
You know, it's interesting. Like, it doesn't mean our culture causes eating disorders, but our culture for sure contributes to it. And I believe I said this on the last show I was on with you, but I like to think about it in a threefold way, that genetics, in terms of somebody who is going to develop an eating disorder, genetics makes the gun, environment loads the gun, and an overwhelming set of emotional circumstances pulls the trigger. Now, we could debate back and forth, and some doctors will debate, is there a genetic gene for an eating disorder? They have not discovered that yet, but is there a genetic predisposition? And I would say, from what I've seen in the 12, 13 years I've worked in the field, every single person who comes in for treatment has somebody in their family who has some sort of either drug or alcohol or eating disorder. So for me, there was definitely, and I come from a family, a long line of alcoholics and addicts. So for me, there's for sure something going on in my genetic makeup that's different than my sister's. Combined with an overwhelming or an environment. So look at our environment, and I'll talk about that in a second. And then an overwhelming set of emotional circumstances pulls the trigger. So when I get a 10-year-old who comes in inpatient, I know something's happened. Something pulled the trigger. And sometimes it can be something as simple as somebody bullying them. Sometimes it's chaos in the home. Sometimes it's sitting in a classroom and a teacher says, you shouldn't eat anything but food that comes from the ground. And that kid, who maybe has a genetic predisposition to this addictive behavior, starts eating only things that they can get from Whole Foods. And they have to have, you know, a need to, like, cope, like we were talking about before, and then they can't stop. So it's just like somebody who tries alcohol and can't stop. It has to also be at a time when you need the alcohol for something, to cope with something. Now, the piece about, and this happens to young kids, it happens to, you know, women in their 60s where that trigger is pulled. Maybe it's been there for their whole life. The thing about food is we have a culture that uses food in terms of good and bad. Now, when you've got a young kid who hears, I can't eat that food, it's bad. And let's say that they are having trouble in their life and feeling very low self-esteem. What do you think they're going to do when they eat McDonald's? This isn't a rhetorical question.
George, you
they
go first.
They did something wrong.
They did something wrong.
And then they're going to feel bad. They feel shame. So we're using food for what food is not meant to be used for in our society. We attach emotions to it. And a young kid, including teenagers, with no frontal lobe fully developed, cannot process that like you and I can. You and I know that we are not bad when we eat McDonald's. A 10-year-old kid does not know that. So we use, in our society, we attach emotions to food, and food is only food. And that is where a lot of mix-up happens in terms of our culture. And then in terms of this thin culture, you know, I'm pretty adamant. When I hear women sitting around talking about how fat they are, how they need to lose weight, or they were so bad today, you know, I stop it because it leads us nowhere, and it drives me crazy because I've been to funerals of people who've died from eating disorders. Not everyone who goes on a diet develops an eating disorder. But eating disorders always start with a diet. And even with young kids, they start with, you know, eating raw or eating healthy. There is an eating disorder that is not in the diagnostic statistics manual yet, which is the what we use to determine eating disorders. But my guess is in the next few years it will be, and it's called orthorexia. And orthorexia is an obsession with health food. And our culture, and I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with eating healthy, but we now have this tipping point where we've tipped over a lot in our culture where it has, there are some people who can't even go out because they're so afraid of the food, of not being able to control their food, which is a problem. We call that orthorexia, and it's not diagnosed yet, but I believe it will be in the next few years.
Don't have that one. No, you know, it's interesting to me as somebody who's in recovery that this would be so much harder, Bill, for me, because you got to eat every day. And, you know, I say I'm trying to eat clean again. Mm-hmm. When I was dying, I ate whatever I want. You know, I figured a God with a bang. But I said the other day, no, I just don't eat anything I like. And my parents had a candy factory growing up. When I eat sugar, I start craving it. And when I eat salty stuff, I start craving it. That's got to be brain or something, right?
Yeah, everyone, I think we talked about this earlier, not on the radio, but just we all have different reactions. Our brains have different reactions to sugar. Not everyone who eats sugar wants a lot of sugar. But those of us with addictive personalities, our brain processes it a little bit different. The thing about food, though, which is so awesome, and when you asked me earlier about what I do differently, when you have an eating disorder, your head is in charge. You no longer are attached to your body. When you have PTSD, which I have, when you have trauma, your trauma lives in your body. So an eating disorder is a great way to not feel your body. So over the years, I'm relearning how to feel my body. And in the process, I'm also relearning how God made my body to know the foods it needs, because we were born intuitive in terms of eating. We were born knowing when we're hungry and knowing when we're full, but somewhere along the way, we get it all messed up. But if we go back to how God made us, if I really listen to my body, it tells me what it needs. And I'm not kidding. Like sometimes I need a milkshake. And so I go get a milkshake because I know that's my body telling me it needs calcium. And if you really listen to your body, it will, God made it that way. It will tell you what it needs. The problem with our society is we don't listen to our body. We tell our body, nobody, you can't have that cookie. Nobody, you can't have that. And then what happens is then we want it more. So what we find is learning to eat in moderation and learning to allow our body to have what it needs is a way to live in moderation. And like I mentioned, nobody's born wanting to be skinny. Nobody's born, you're not born that way. You're born intuitive eating, and it's a process to get back to that, and it's a very challenging process.
I thought I got the green light there on the donuts for a minute. I have heard that people who suffer from eating disorders, it's a control issue. Is there anything to that?
Oh, for sure. I mean, for me, absolutely. Like, for me, the eating, like I said, it didn't have anything to do with how I looked on the outside. It was about controlling. If I could just think about calories and think about my weight, I didn't have to think about anything else. I didn't have to think about how I felt. I didn't have to think about how sad I was. I could just sit and obsess about numbers and calories and kind of ruminate about it. Then it left no room for emotions, which was the whole point.
Okay.
I didn't want to feel. So now here, then in recovery, I have to sit in my emotions. I have to sit through the dark parts, you know, that I have to sit through the trauma and deal with it. But I know I'm sitting and re-healing from it with Jesus next to me. But yeah, absolutely about control. I mean, and control is for sure the reason why it works.
Okay, so if you get into recovery on this, you've got to start feeling things that you were trying to numb out before.
Yes.
But you had talked about, I thought there was kind of a high to the eating disorder,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did you miss that as well?
I don't think I missed the high, because here's what started to happen. what happens too when you stop eating is you get so numb, right? So I also, in the beginning I would get high, but then I ended up getting so numb that I had no feelings, which is why suicide then becomes an option, because you're just, or cutting becomes something that people do because you are so numb. So then when I started in recovery and I started feeling and having emotions again, you can't numb out bad feelings without numbing out good feelings. So yeah, I was numb, but I wasn't having good feelings anymore either. So once I started started living life in recovery and started doing the things I needed to do, I started to find I could laugh again. And it wasn't like fake laugh. It was like, I'm really laughing. And I started to feel joy again. And I started to feel tears that didn't, you know, I was afraid that the tears would never stop. And they would come and then they would go, which is how emotions are. They're like waves. So I started to feel whole again. I started to feel like a whole person again. So no, I didn't miss it, because I was now starting to be a human being who could have emotions, which I lived most of my life tampering them down. Now I'm just relearning how to have them and that they're okay. And, you know, you look at scripture and you look at David and, you know, I mean, we're allowed to have emotions. We are human beings. And I think often in our Christian culture, we're like, oh, don't cry, or just pray and you'll be fine, or trust in the Lord with all your heart. No, you know what? I'm a human being, and I lament. I rejoice. I have days of, you know, mundaneness, all of it, and all of it is okay.
Lee, I'm curious about, I want to get back to the start of your story, as we're now just 3 minutes left in the show, where you felt like you were the odd person out in the family. And I'm curious as to how your sisters interacted with you when you were going through some of your problems when you were younger. Did you get support from them? Were they giving you the big eye roll, like, oh, here we go again, Lee's being dramatic? And then when you are now have someone that you love in your life that has an eating disorder, what's the best approach to take with them?
So I'm confused what you're asking. So
I asked two questions.
Yeah. So you're asking, did my siblings, I had a sister and a brother.
Okay.
Did my siblings...
Were they supportive of you, or did they feel like you were a little bit off the rails?
They didn't know what to do.
Okay.
I think there wasn't a lot of information out there
okay.
at that point in time. They didn't know what to do, and which is exactly why I wrote the book.
Okay.
I wrote the book because I had nobody in my life that I knew who had recovered from an eating disorder, and I believed if God said you will be healed, I believed in that, and so I wanted people to know that you can recover. I think they were just scared. They didn't know what to do. My parents were terrified. They did everything possible that they could do. I will tell you, we've had difficulties. My family has had challenges and difficulties, and we've had to learn to repair. I've had to learn to set some pretty clear boundaries. And the one thing that my parents did that was the best thing that they could do, and I tell every parent I work with the same thing, it wasn't my parents' job to fix me. It wasn't my parents' job to cure me. Same with my siblings. But what they kept doing, and they still do today, is they said this one phrase. And my parents aren't believers, but this was my life raft. They said, Lee, we love you, we support you, and we believe you can recover from this. Even when I was lying in the ICU unit of a hospital. Do I think they believed that? I don't know if they did, but they kept saying that. We love you. We support you. We believe you can do this. And now on the other side of it, they say, Lee, we love you. We're so sorry for everything that happened, and we are so proud of you.
That's so beautiful.
That's nice.
I'm tearing up. George, another award-winning episode of Real Recovery.
Great show. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
If you want to hear this interview again, or if you missed any of it, you definitely want to go back. Go to myfaithradio.com. Go to Real Recovery and check it out. You may know a friend or have someone in your life that you love and care about that this message would be very helpful for. So send it on, and thank you for supporting Faith Radio. We've got our fall share coming up this week, so we're awfully glad if you can be part of that. Thank you so much for listening. Good night, and God bless. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.